This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 4th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A suicide bombing in Gaza threatens an already fragile ceasefire. A prince becomes king in Nepal as 9 members of the royal family are killed at dinner. And Los Angeles gears up for what could be an historic mayor's race if they elect its first Latino mayor since the Gold Rush. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Saying federal executions might be racially motivated, a citizens group asks President Bush to stop them. More from Ellen Ratner in D.C.
A coalition group, the Citizens for a Moratorium on Federal Executions, sent a letter today to President Bush calling for an immediate federal moratorium on the death penalty. Robert Litt, a signer of the letter and associate attorney general under Clinton, argues,
if you are going to have a death penalty, it has to be applied fairly and equitably as opposed to arbitrarily and randomly.
Litt also rebukes Attorney General Ashcroft for not continuing an investigation first started by the Clinton administration that examines racial and geographical disparities of the death penalty.
The difference is now that there is a sense coming out from the Department of Justice that they have no intention of doing the studies and intend to proceed with executions.
The letter is a direct response to the scheduled execution of Juan Raul Garza, who has been convicted of 3 drug-related murders. President Clinton put a stay on his execution before he left office due to his concern about racial disparities. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio, I'm Ellen Ratner.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court has reversed the death sentence of a Texas man who, his lawyers say, has the mental abilities of a 7-year-old. This is the second time the court has overturned Johnny Paul Penry's execution. In today's ruling, the court said the jurors in the case did not get clear instructions on how to weigh Perry's mental capabilities with the nature of his crime. The court will deal with the constitutionality of executing the mentally retarded in another case in the fall. In a different matter, the court voted 8-0 to throw out a cap on the damages that a harassed employee can win. Civil liberties and workers' rights groups argue that the cap is arbitrary and benefits businesses. The court said that workers who are wronged on the job are entitled to more than just the normal pay they would have received had they not suffered the harassment. Allies of Connecticut Governor John Rowland are fuming over the Republican governor's pledge to sign a bill that would impose strict pollution controls on 6 of the state's oldest and dirtiest power plants. From Hartford, Connecticut, Ebong Udoma reports.
Supporters of the legislation, mostly Democrats, say the bill is needed to protect the health of those living near Connecticut's 6 oil and coal-burning power plants. Opponents, mostly Republicans, say it could affect the reliability of the state's power supply. They say they are shocked and angry that Governor Rowland is refusing to veto the bill. Governor Rowland is blaming Republicans for passing the bill in the state Senate with an overwhelming 35-4 majority.
The whole issue was about politics. It wasn't about clean air. It was a fight in the House over leadership a year and a half from now, and we all know that it was a political gamesmanship. The Senate leader was running around saying that let's get the bill passed in the Senate so the governor will have to veto it, we'll embarrass him.
Now that he's set to sign the bill, Rowland's usual critics are praising him for protecting the environment. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ebong Udama in Hartford.
Finally, hundreds gathered to protest the logging of ancient trees and the loggers' use of force against those tree-sitting to stop the cutting. Estelle Fennell reports from Redway, California.
Called Acting in Concert, the rally included well-known names such as Sherry Glazer, famed for her one-woman off-Broadway hit Oh My Goddess, and activist singers such as Casey, who brought up the nonviolent activists' concerns about how loggers are responding to them.
By our standards, and we want to keep our standards as high as possible, things are getting scary. And I'm hearing friends of mine say stuff like, I'm surprised that no one has died. And I look around at my friends here and think, if someone were to get killed again, who would it be? It's terrifying. So,
some who attended and spoke out were responding with defiance to the timber company's lawsuit against activists and their supporters. They included longtime watershed restoration expert Richard Ginger, who referred to the fact that despite the protests, logging had already been completed on 2 of the plans.
Everybody that's committed themselves to the Mattole is to be thanked and to be supported. And even if things are lost, trees are lost, places lost, lives lost. We cannot stop. We cannot stop.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Estelle Fennell in Northern California.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
A brittle ceasefire was in danger today by a gun battle in the Gaza Strip that followed a dramatic drop-off in the number of shooting incidents since Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat called a truce. With more from the Gaza Strip, we have this update from Raphael Kraft.
In the cafes, hairdressing salons, or markets, the inhabitants of the Gaza Strips have had their ears stuck on the radio, lying in wait for the latest news since Friday night's suicide bomb attack in Tel Aviv that killed 20 people. These very radios and televisions have transmitted the order proceeding from the Palestinian Authority to keep the sets on for the next hours, to have reservations on water and food. Yet, the mini-markets haven't been taken by storm. Palestinians are used to restrictions. Despite the escalation of tension of the latest days, there's a feeling of déjà vu in the streets of Gaza, although the streets are getting more and more empty since Saturday morning. Mohammed, who lives near the central Palestinian police station and the 417 headquarters, keeps rolling his shawarmas and broiling his kebabs.
They will take suddenly decision not to make consulting in the, this what they call Knesset. Just suddenly, we'll do this, we'll do this.
You're not afraid?
What we'll do? If there's bombs coming, we'll run away or we'll stay in our places. I have four children. What we'll do? I will hold it and run away. That's what I will do. Where I will hide, we don't know where they will attack, here or there. No one's know.
Not far from his cheap restaurant, the United Nations, the British Council, and many other international organizations have evacuated some of their expatriate personnel out of the Gaza Strip. After Israeli authorities advised this organization to display their colors on top of their buildings in case of an attack, members of the United Nations Refugee Work Agency were panicking last Saturday morning. They had lost their flag. Olivier Mézouet is the head of international NGO Doctors Without Borders.
We are waiting for something maybe to happen, but we don't really know. The decision we took is that we made contact with our headquarters in Paris and Barcelona to have some medical equipment ready in case of big emergency, and also we have a medical team of surgeons ready to arrive here in Palestine, either in Gaza Strip or in the West Bank. And we also decided that the people that were not really needed for the work were sent to Jerusalem.
But the bombs haven't fallen yet. Both Ariel Sharon and Yasser Arafat find themselves under strong international pressure. The first is forced to restrain the Israeli Defense Force from retaliating, and the latter to impose a ceasefire on its occupied people. In Tel Aviv, the street is raging for a strong response to the last suicide bomb attack. In a poll by a Palestinian institution published yesterday, 3 Palestinians out of 4 wish to continue the Intifada. Ahwa, a young student in Gaza Al-Azhar University, is among the moderates.
We didn't think to kill children, to kill civil persons, but we haven't any choice. We have to let them taste the taste of pain, that there's persons have to be killed like our Riyadh and like our children. We have to pay back. We have to take our land, to take our rights. We need to live a normal life.
While the diplomatic game keeps being played by both parties in the forefront of the international scene, Israel has tightened the closure on Palestinian territories. This afternoon, gunfires have been exchanged in between Israeli forces and Palestinians in Rafah, in the south of the Gaza Strip, an area of very difficult access due to the presence of an Israeli checkpoint cutting the Gaza Strip in two. The consequence is a complete demediatization of the zone where facts remain vague and easily deniable in front of the cameras. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in the Gaza Strip.
Prince Gyanendra inherited Nepal's throne from his dead relatives today, becoming king as police fired tear gas at rioting youth who demanded an explanation of a shooting that killed 9 royals. Nepal's King Birendra was killed Friday evening along with most of the royal family at a palace dinner party. For our coverage of this story, correspondent James Smoot reports from Nepal.
News of the shooting has stunned Nepal, already reeling from its worst political crisis in history.
Kathmandu is convulsed with rioting around the royal palace today, with protesters demanding a proper explanation of Friday night's mass killing of almost the entire royal family. Groups of youth threw stones at police cordons near the palace, and police responded with tear gas grenades and baton charges. Kathmandu is under a shoot-on-site curfew until dawn tomorrow, but people are still on the streets and police seem to be making no attempt to clear them. There are no reports of deaths, but dozens of people have been injured.
On Saturday morning, hundreds of people gathered in the palace square to try and learn more news. The mood on the square was that of shock and disbelief. Krishna, an employee of Action Aid, a non-governmental aid agency, learned of the news just after midnight.
Very shocking for me. You know? I just heard this news about, you know, it's midnight. I could not sleep at all. You know, it's really very shocking news for me.
The Nepalese government made no formal announcement until 2 p.m. on Saturday, 14 hours after the shooting. When the announcement came, it spoke only of the untimely demise of the king and his family and the announcement of the funeral procession. On Sunday, the new regent, Prince Gyanendra, said the shooting was an accident caused when the machine gun went off. Most people in Kathmandu heard the news from the BBC and other foreign media, and they are not buying the murder-suicide story or the accident statement. Raj, a university student, suspects India. With no access to the sea, Nepal is dependent on India for almost all of its trade. India has in the past closed its border to enforce its will on the Nepalese government. India is widely suspected for wanting to absorb Nepal as it did the Himalayan kingdom of Sikkim.
When they, you know, Nepal got the democracy, yes. That time also, you know, they sealed the border and all. Whenever Nepal got problem, you know, they are always trying to get Nepal in, you know, like Sikkim. So I don't want to say anything, but we have lost everything, you know, now.
Nepalese find such an American-style family massacre inconceivable. This is a very traditional Hindu society where one's parents are revered to the point of worship. The king was widely seen as an incarnation of the Hindu god Vishnu. In the absence of information from the government, rumors are flying around Kathmandu as to who is truly responsible for this atrocity. While Indian involvement is widely suspected, the prime suspect for the people is the king's brother Gyanendra and his son, the universally hated Paras. According to Hindu custom, the king, the queen, and 3 other family members were cremated less than 24 hours after their deaths. The majority of Kathmandu's population packed the city's narrow streets to see the open biers of the king and other family members. Gyanendra and the vastly unpopular Prime Minister Koirala marched in the procession, but were greeted with verbal abuse. Riot police had to beat off stone-throwing mobs to protect them. The death of the king leaves Nepal in a desperate political situation. With the parliamentary government almost entirely discredited in the public's eyes and the probable succession of Gyanendra to the throne, state power is on the verge of collapse. The Maoist insurgency already controls half the country and stands to gain even more support. The situation in Kathmandu is incredibly tense. People are shocked and angry but showed no signs of pulling together behind the government. There is talk of a possible military coup or a declaration of martial law. The next week will be critical. For Free Speech Radio News, this is James Smoot in Kathmandu.
After a series of lively debates, former L.A. City Attorney James Hahn and Antonio Villaraigosa and former State Assembly Speaker will face each other tomorrow in a runoff election that will give the winner the position of mayor of the City of Angels. If Villaraigosa wins, he will become the first Latino mayor of L.A. in over a century, since the gold rush. But as Fernando Velasquez reports, the big challenge for the two candidates is how to bring this diverse city together.
Organization for Women, the Sierra Club, the County Federation of Labor, and important sectors of the African-American and Jewish religious establishments are supporting Villaraigosa. But some members of the progressive community feel neither candidate is doing enough. Michael Simpson, activist and co-founder of the Coalition Against Police Abuse, charges that both politicians have failed to address the real issues.
I think that both of them have had some, as being liberals, some sense of consciousness about issues in the community. But liberals are notorious for flip-flopping. So they're all caught up in this, and this is what people, I think, politically have got to begin developing their own politics. They've got to begin developing their own issues and demands based on their familiarity with those in the community, and began calling for demands such as an end to three strikes, such as an elimination of the Prop 21 attack on youth, the criminalization of our youth.
Antonio, from the very beginning of his campaign, has talked about an independent review of not only the LAPD, but of all the jurisdictions, all of the agencies involved in what created Rampart. That starts with the LAPD, but should extend to the city attorney, the district attorney, and all of the other prosecuting agencies.
Villaraigosa's press secretary. Many observers believe Villaraigosa's drop in the polls is due in part to a television ad that depicts him defending a drug dealer and soft on crime. During the last debate, the charismatic Chicano accused Han of creating a campaign of fear.
If that was true, the opening frame wouldn't be a crack cocaine needle and someone cutting up crack cocaine. We know what you're trying to do, Jimmy. You're trying to create a climate of fear. You're trying to say to the people of Los Angeles that they can't trust me.
Han held his ground and assured the audience that the ad is correct. A few years ago, the former city attorney supported Police Chief Daryl Gates on the aftermath of the Rodney King beating, and if elected, he may become a shot in the arm to the L.A. troubled police. His broad coalition includes Mexican-American politician Richard Polanco, a large number of African-Americans, including Congresswoman Maxine Waters, some conservatives, and trade unions. And Villaraigosa is perceived by progressives as a great hope to bring the city's diverse communities together. But for activist Michael Simpson, the two have many things in common, and some not necessarily what the community needs.
That's why I say it would be interesting to see either one of them as liberals enter into the arena, because they're being expected to maintain the interests of the elite.
For Free Speech Radio News in Los Angeles, this is Fernando Velázquez.
Since the late 1990s, a resurgence of student activism has been evident on campuses across the country. Students have organized anti-sweatshop campaigns in support of the rights of workers around the globe who make university apparel and equipment. Harvard students recently ended a successful 21-day sit-in demanding living wages to boost the wages of campus janitors, groundkeepers, and other low-income workers. At the same time, students are also seeking union representation for the work they do as teaching assistants. On this day three of a strike staged by teaching assistants at the University of Washington, Martha Baskin reports neither side appeared willing to talk over the weekend.
3 days before final exams, teaching assistants at the University of Washington have declared a strike. Less than a year and a half ago, the teaching assistants, graders, readers, and tutors formed a union, GSAC, in affiliation with the United Auto Workers, who've helped organize teaching personnel in Michigan, California, and Massachusetts. Kristen Intiman, a teaching assistant in the university's philosophy department.
The core issues that sort of underlie everything are making sure that, you know, GSAC UAW gets represented or recognized as the exclusive bargaining agent for TAs, readers, tutors, and graders, so that we can actually have a contract that is, you know, that is fully enforceable by a neutral third party. And part of the reason why we want that is also to address issues which are also sort of sticking points with the university, such as workload, stronger non-discrimination and harassment protections, making sure that the hiring process is transparent, there's fair job posting, making sure that we have certain job security protections, you know, things like that.
The university maintains that it needs state legislative as well as statutory authority to grant exclusive bargaining rights to the union. Norm Arkins, Assistant Vice President for Public Relations at the university.
You know, we're a public university, and the rules that govern union relationships at public universities in the country are not rules from the National Labor Relations Board. Those pertain to the private sector. And so the private universities in the East, and NYU in particular, come under NRLB rules. As a state agency, we're not subject to those, and so our union relationships are all governed by statutes, laws that are passed in the state.
Last December, a strike was averted when the union agreed to compromise with the university and seek legislation that would craft new law defining who's in the bargaining unit and what may be bargained. The legislation fell victim to a split legislature and failed. Some legislative leaders, however, as well as the state's Public Employment Relations Commission, have told the university that legislation is unnecessary before entering into a collective bargaining relationship with the union. Steve Marquardt, director of the university's Center for Labor Studies.
In general, this is a part of a repertoire of stalls that university administrations across the country have used when dealing with union movements like this. They generally, at this point in a union struggle with teaching assistants, maintain that in some way they're not permitted by statutory authority to do what the union wants. They'd like to, but ...
The University of California system is a case in point. The Board of Regents said for years that they couldn't recognize teaching personnel unions without legislative authority until a series of campus strikes and pressure from legislators caused them to change their mind. For the time being, the two sides remain at an impasse. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin in Seattle.
Nearly 100 protesters rallied outside the Manhattan office of Governor Pataki to protest the support of bringing 10 power plants online that would be built in poor, highly polluted neighborhoods. Demonstrators also demand a moratorium on new power plants until the state's energy plan is finished next year. Jeff Brady has the story.
We need an energy plan!
Not another power plant!
Members of CURE, or Communities for Responsible Energy, shout protest chants over the noise of Manhattan traffic. A looming smokestack prop grabs the attention of passersby.
Pataki, where are you? The people are here! The people are speaking!
5 years ago, the Pataki administration unveiled a plan to deregulate the power market at a time when utilities produced more than the customer demand. But in the last few years, demand increased. Using the fear of California-style rolling blackouts, the New York Power Authority and other power suppliers have proposed 21 power plants for New York. If demand rises under the current deregulation policy, residents will be at the mercy of the market. 10 new power plants are scheduled to go online this month, most of them located in low-income communities. Organizer Eddie Bautista calls the state energy plan environmental injustice and racist.
At this point, we're talking about reductions. These communities are in no position to see any more of an increase in pollution. And if the governor's running on an environmental mandate, he better begin looking at communities of color that are suffering from the impacts of disproportionate environmental harm.
Bautista says an increase in particulate pollution would be devastating to certain neighborhoods in Sunset Park and Williamsburg of Brooklyn, and in the South Bronx, where asthma counts are already high. Each 44-megawatt gas-burning turbine can produce up to 60 tons annually of pollution, such as sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, and NOx. But Joe Leary, spokesman for the New York Power Authority, says the new power plants are the most environmentally friendly, and there are plans to reduce the power plant emission.
These actually are the cleanest plants in the city of New York, that we do have the zero emissions policy in effect, that we pledge to offset these emissions. Zero emissions means that as low as emissions come out of these plants, somewhere in that community, we are going to take a source of emissions and eliminate it.
Bautista says there's no such a thing as zero emissions, and those are standards assessed by the New York Power Authority. Sunset Park resident Missouri Onauda says she spent many days indoors with asthma, and since two power plant turbines have gone up in her Brooklyn community, she believes her neighborhood has been unfairly targeted.
If we were rich white people, like they said, this wouldn't have happened. Why is it in racial communities? Why is it where people have low income? Why is it where people don't make good money? Why is it where the people don't even speak English? Because they know that they won't fight back. But you know what? We are fighting back. The little bit of us, we keep on adding up. We add up by day. Newer forces, new people that care.
Leary cites technical criteria such as available land, gas and electric hookups nearby as reasons why power plants were built in Latino communities and low-income neighborhoods. He also says that some minority leaders have backed the locations of these new power plants.
We also have the support of the National Minority Business Council, which is minority owners, to add these power plants.
They're lying right there. We did not agree to not one thing. Why would we agree to something that's going to cause us to have cancer? Why would we agree to something that would cause us to getting asthma? See, that's a lie. They lied right there. They're always lying. Money talks these days. Money talks big time.
Meanwhile, the Cure organization has filed a lawsuit that's pending in appeals court. It calls for a moratorium on siting any new power plants until the state updates its energy plan next year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeff Brady in New York.
The developers of the proposed Staples Sport and Entertainment Complex in Los Angeles have reached an unprecedented agreement with a coalition of unions, churches, and religious groups to provide a package of community benefits worth an estimated $20 to $30 million. In return, the activist groups agree to support the massive project and back Staples' request for a city subsidy to build it. Robin Yurovich has more.
The Staples developers plan a transformation of downtown Los Angeles with a 1,200-room hotel, a 7,000-seat theater, and dozens of restaurants, bars, and shops. The benefits agreement creates an unusual alliance between the developers, among them media mogul Rupert Murdoch and L.A. Kings owner Philip Anschutz, and the Figueroa Corridor Coalition for Economic Justice, which represents some of the poorest residents of Los Angeles. Madeline Janice Aparicio, who directs the city's Living Wage Coalition, says the deal could be a model for the rest of the nation.
I know of no more comprehensive package in any development that any community group has negotiated in the country. You know, bringing together jobs, housing, environment, parks is unique and, you know, really exciting.
Under the agreement, the Staples Complex future retail tenants who don't receive any city money will nonetheless have to comply with the city's living wage law. Of the estimated 5,000 jobs to be created by the project, Staples says its goal will be to have 70% of them pay what the city defines as a living wage, $7.72 an hour with health benefits and $8.97 without. Staples has also agreed to build up to 160 affordable housing units, provide $1 million for neighborhood parks, and give first preference to neighborhood residents for permanent jobs. It's unclear how much taxpayer assistance the sports and entertainment complex developers will request. It's likely to be in the tens of millions. But the coalition's Madeline Janice Aparicio says taxpayers will be getting a good deal.
You know, on one hand, there's a legitimate issue about giving subsidies to very wealthy companies. On the other hand, subsidies gives us the ability to become directly involved in the project and to ask for real things for the community.
Staples spokesman Chris Majeski says the agreement is a continuation of his company's labor-friendly policies.
We have a track record with Staples Center of being a union or living wage facility. We saw this as an opportunity to build upon the success we've had with our experience with the arena and view this as a great opportunity.
Still, the agreement relieves Staples of some major headaches. Under the PAC, the signatory groups will not only support the project at the city council, they won't protest against it or sue the developers. Not everyone is pleased with the deal. Activists who are trying to limit alcohol sales say they don't like the 24 additional liquor outlets the project will bring to their neighborhood. Staples is still in negotiations with five labor unions involved in the project. This week, they're likely to announce an agreement that will set aside some of the project's jobs for union members and make it easier for those workers who aren't to join a union. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Robin Yurovich in Los Angeles.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on four continents and in 14 states are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For more information, go to the strike's website at www.savepacifica.net/strike. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.